You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
One minute after 8 o'clock here on the West Coast, Frank Sinatra joins us. And also joining me is Tom Drowdy. Sir, good morning. How are you?
Great, Mac. Good to hear you again.
All right. Are you a Sinatra guy?
Oh, yeah, you bet. Well, my wife is Sicilian, so I have no choice.
In a lot of things. Interesting. You know, I had a chance to meet your wife for the first time this morning when she answered the phone. So very nice to meet her.
You caught me out doing my PFT. That's a bit of an exaggeration. Yeah. She also served in the Marine Corps. So
I remember.
You got the twofer here.
Give everybody, sir, joined the Marine Corps what year?
1962, commissioned in June of 62, and retired 1 January of 93, so 30 and a half years. Infantry officer, joined a transplanted battalion in 63, went overseas to Okinawa, took my platoon into Vietnam in 64, and then we went back as a battalion in 65, 66, extended my tour to stay as a company commander. And then went back to Vietnam third time in 69 to 70 as an advisor of Vietnamese Marines. And then later commanded 5th Marines, we were both a part of. And then was the assistant division commander of 1st Marine Division in Desert Shield, Desert Storm, and retired as director of public affairs.
Talk to me about, this has been an absolute, amazing kind of intellectual endeavor for me. One, just the whole subject matter of My Lai. And then for me personally, no stranger to the law of land warfare and no stranger to being, fighting an insurgency. And, we're an all volunteer force now. We're a professional force. With professional NCOs, professional staff NCOs. And so you look back at the Vietnam era and what it was like to lead during that period, and you think, holy smokes, the nation goes to war for the first time as an integrated force. Black soldiers are fighting next to white soldiers. Hispanic soldiers have always, I think, been a part of the force. Maybe not a large part, but they have served. But black soldiers not in frontline combat units integrated, and the issue of civil rights is not decided in the nation yet. You have the drug thing in Vietnam that we read and see about it that I don't, you know, I still don't really understand. We have a war. These are the grandsons of the guys who fought World War One, the sons of guys who fought World War Two, the brothers, the younger brothers of guys who fought in Korea. And they're going off to, you know, to go up Mount Suribachi. But the war they fight is unlike anyone we fought since fighting the American Indians on the plains. And so it's much different. And even one of the educations I've got doing the program for the last year is depending on what year you were in Vietnam and where you were located, your experience was vastly different than other people. But the backdrop of all of that is the environment in which you led. So I wanted to have it's been really interesting to me to have Vietnam veterans on. And then as I've asked Vietnam veterans, you know, tell me about My Lai, it's been an incredible experience, their emotional response to that. And I don't mean emotionally and crying. I mean the rawness still, 50 years later, of what they feel about how that characterized their service, how many people were painted with that brush, and how much they want to talk about that. And just since you and I spoke earlier this morning, I got an email back from somebody who I want to come on the program, who was a Marine officer in Vietnam. And here's the response, and it's really interesting. And this guy got out as a general officer, okay? Any day but next Thursday. You are right. It was different. We fought two different kind of wars, the DMZ area and then the Da Nang AO and southward. Also, please don't forget to ask me about My Lai. Let me know the time of day. Now, most of the time, you don't get that kind of, please don't forget to ask me about My Lai. That's not a subject a lot of people embrace. But what I find really interesting about Vietnam veterans is that they want to talk about it. And it's just been really astounding. And then the other part of this, sir, that you and I have talked about a lot on this program is the whole concept of ethical leadership, keep your honor clean. And one of the things that you notice in spades about this, about My Lai, is that, and I quote Maximus from Gladiator when I talk about this, what we do in life echoes in eternity. It certainly echoes in your own soul through eternity. And if you compromise yourself, if you compromise your honor, you can never get away from it. And it is one of the saddest parts of Vietnam is that for the rest of their lives, these soldiers live with what they do. And a lot of them don't live very well with it. And they can never get away with it. They can never get away from it. So I'm curious as to what was it like? I'll ask you a general question. What was it like to lead Marines in? And again, you have three different trips over there. What was it like to lead Marines then?
Yeah, you've given a great synopsis, Mac, and have done your homework well. And I think the most poignant point is Vietnam. Asking someone about it depends upon where they were when, because it is so different based upon the location as well as the time. But my early days, early tours in Vietnam, 64 and again 65 and 66, it was as an ideal situation as one could have. I was a part of what is called a transplacement battalion that had trained in Camp Pendleton and then as a battalion departed for Okinawa. And with that, my platoon was selected to go into Vietnam in 64. But these were all Marines that we knew each other. We had trained with one another. I mean, when I commanded Mike 37, I knew not only every Marine in my company, but his hometown, education level, if he was married and not many were, the name of wife, children, I mean, That's how intimate that relationship and how well we knew one another and therefore went to war in that regard. Then we went back in 65 and 65. It was half that unit that had served overseas already, and then the new unit that had come in, and we started training again. So it was I guess in a similar fashion to the units we're sending into Iraq and Afghanistan. We send them as units. Later on in Vietnam, of course, it became individual replacements, and with that, the challenges of the new guy, you know, could you trust him, would he fit in, I mean, all those things that made it different, far different from my earlier experience. But the My Lai situation, let me stop at that point. So leading in those days, and these were, of course, we had in my time, all volunteers, but later on in Vietnam, we had draftees who were in the Marine Corps. They turned out to be great Marines as well, so there was not a thing of, gee, because you're a draftee, you're a bad Marine, or you're not really a Marine, that they served well and faithfully also. But once again, it was a different situation because of that unique, I guess maybe too strong a word, but really a tremendous advantage of serving together, training together, and knowing one another before we went into combat. So that was the days of 64 and 65. Now, again, as I indicated to you, in 69 and 70, I was an advisor, so I didn't have contact really with the U.S. Marines.
Where were you an advisor? What part of the country?
Primarily in 3 Corps and 4 Corps in Delta, and then in 1970, I was a part of the group that went into Cambodia as part of that incursion. So I had a chance to serve in all 4 Corps areas of Vietnam during my 3 tours there.
Wow. The one of the interesting pieces, that the data points that comes up about My Lai is it happens in Charlie Company, 1st Battalion of the 20th Infantry Regiment of the United States Army. The guy who lands his helicopter, a warrant officer by the name of Hugh Thompson, is not part of the company, right? He's part of the aviation battalion. Okay. So, and then other people he calls in are part of the aviation battalion, and then people heard them talking, and they flew over. So the aviation battalion is part of the initial reporting to the brigade that something very wrong happened there. The other data point that comes in that makes the AmeriCal division makes them culpable in not investigating is from the advisors. The advisors heard from the village elders about this. And the first number, time you see a number of between 400 and 500, comes through the advisor chain of reporting back up to the AmeriCal division. And neither one of those triggers any type of substantive investigation, which is kind of incredible when you think about it. Before we talk, My Lai, and get your thoughts on that, I'm curious. The backdrop of Vietnam, again, Apocalypse Now paints a picture of it. You have soldiers wearing jewelry. You have their uniforms marked up, essentially worn however they want to. You have drugs. You have drugs, and then you have racial strife. Talk to me about what was your experience relative to the level of discipline that you experienced?
Well, again, this will sound to many listeners, I guess, very idealistic and Pollyannish, but you know that. Again, because we had trained with one another and knew one another, those things would be anathema. I mean, we were Marines going into combat. We knew one another. I had Black Marines, Hispanic Marines, American Indian Marines, but you know they're all Marines. That was the main factor. And all those things that you've described as far as drugs, I mean, that would be absolutely unheard of. First of all, 65 was kind of early, I guess, in maybe the drug culture, but nevertheless, to think of a Marine taking a drug from marijuana to anything more severe or more serious and endanger the life of another Marine was just, anathema. That isn't the way Marines operate, and that's not what we did. So, and the racial thing is interesting that you raised that. As a company commander, I put out the word to the company that we don't call the Vietnamese, whether they're Viet Cong, NVA, the villagers and so forth, we don't call them gooks or dinks or slopes or zipper. I mean, all of those racial F-death, you know, that's not part of what we, in the same way that we don't call a fellow Marine, who is black, the N-word. We don't call, the Hispanic Marines. So it was part of an innate feeling that once you start to denigrate a human being, then it's easier to treat them as less than human. And so, that was just kind of the culture, at least, that I tried to establish. Was,
now,
you know,
okay, so
fight them well, absolutely. Kill them when necessary, absolutely. But, you know, there was no desecration. There was no, you know, they were the enemy, but there still had to be, you know, we had to retain our humanness in this this horrible thing called war, and it was, in many ways, a constant struggle.
How did you... Where did you learn that? Where does that come from? Because, you know, that's not easy to do in combat. You know, it's not easy to do in peacetime when you're at war and you hear those words and you know, for us it would have been ragheads and Hajis and, you know, and it is the whole process of dehumanizing your enemy. And depending on how far you go down that road, you do so at the peril of your own soul, you know. And so, where did that come from? Did it come? Was it just you innately? Did you have other officers that sat down and tell you, you can't go down that road? If you do, then bad things have a tendency, you know, will happen.
Mac, I think it's a combination of the way we were raised, and in my case, as I told you, I had 12 years of Catholic education, you know, so the priests and nuns and the brothers, I mean, it was a constant reminder of you know, you're supposed to be a man, Droughty, but you're supposed to also be a Catholic Christian man, and there's certain principles that you're supposed to live up to, and with it comes Catholic guilt, which is a part of it as well, but then the way you're raised, the way your parents bring you up, the friends that you are surrounded with, the friends of your parents, you know, what do they stand for and what they don't stand for, and all of those things. And of course, I was raised in a very patriotic community, but that was the situation. I was born in 1940, so I remember World War II and the tremendous surge of patriotism of serving, but it was, you know, to serve, you know, well and faithfully. It wasn't to go off and be a criminal. It was to go off and serve your country. And, you know, with it comes the conscience that I think has to exist in all of us, but most especially in the leaders, because our decisions have such ramifications. I remember one time talking with one of my lieutenants who said, you know, we capture Viet Cong suspects, and probably with a little bit of inducement, we could get more information from them. And of course, what he was telling me was that he wanted to torture. And I said, you know, absolutely not. You know, that's not what we stand for. And if you authorize that, you know, where does that stop? Does that become delegated to the platoon sergeant, and then to the squad leaders, and then the fire team leader? You know, absolutely not. But, you know, that was not just a matter of the law of land warfare. That was, you know, how we treat human beings, even if they're our enemy, and most especially if they're between us and the enemy, those poor civilians who bear the brunt of war from time immemorial.
I've got an email for you. Mac, clearly Tom Droughty is the wrong person to have this conversation with. He obviously is an incredible leader by virtue of the positions that he held, being the commanding officer of the historic 5th Marine Regiment, and then rising to the rank of a general officer. I'm curious, because I did not serve in Vietnam either. The stories of rape are astounding to me, that this would happen as Marines and soldiers moved on a combat mission, that somebody would have the time to stop and rape somebody with others either standing around, listening and watching, or walking by and doing nothing. What did he see in adjacent units? Did he see these issues, or was it simply not really present while he was in Vietnam? I appreciate the discussion. It's been riveting the last few days, and I can't seem to get away from it. It does occupy my mind even after I stop listening. Thank you. So, Tom, obviously you're an atypical leader by virtue of your career. The units adjacent to you, did you see the issues there? And I'm curious about your thoughts of the whole subject of rape. It's something that's associated with American service members in Vietnam.
Surely. Yeah. Well, first of all, no, I did not see it, nor was I aware of it in adjacent units. because, and again, I get back to the aspect of leadership. Now, we had some good leaders and some not so good leaders in the Marine Corps and with the units that I was with, and so, but regardless of their tactical proficiency or obtuseness at times, they were not individuals who were going to condone a criminal act like rape or murder. First of all, because I honestly don't believe that they were the types who would do that, even under the stresses of war. But secondly, the accountability was so strict, as it should be, of, as an officer, you are responsible for everything that happens or fails to happen in your unit. And so you must know what's going on, and you can't use the Yamashita precedent of, gee, I just didn't know what was happening, so don't hold me accountable. That just didn't exist. So, and again, it sounds maybe too anti-Hollywood, but that's the way it was in the units that I was with, and those that I served with and were near me. But let me just touch or connect this to Mi Lai. One of the horrible things that came out of Mi Lai was that in accepting what happened there, it lowered the expectations of those who had served and were serving. And so because of Mi Lai and the testimony, the result, I mean, those horrible things that took place, in the minds of some Americans, many Americans, all of us were like that. We were, in the words of some individuals, the baby killers that was leveled against us. And it's interesting that on the same day that the court martial was finalized, Cali's unit suffered 33 killed at a fire support base called Marianne, and the notion was that happened because of drugs and alcohol and lackness, and that the American Army was truly losing its grip. So Mi Lai became kind of a new low standard for what to expect for those who were serving and had served in Vietnam. And that's why I think you get this visceral reaction from so many Vietnam veterans about Mi Lai. That wasn't me. That wasn't what we did. That isn't what we stood for. And then the times that we ensured that those things didn't happen, become even more dramatic in our minds, but the more egregious thought that we could be lumped into the same category as Lieutenant Kelly, a person who never should have been able to lead anything, and his individuals is what is so atrocious for at least me as a Vietnam veteran.
I have another email question for you. Mac, I'm curious what General Droughty's reaction is when he hears the audio that comes out of these different clips that you play, where Cali and various squad leaders profess to have no understanding of the law of land warfare. An order is an order. You can be shot for disobeying an order in the face of the enemy. I hear this and it astounds me that officers and non-commissioned officers of the United States Army would not look at their company commander and say, we're not doing this. I heard yesterday a number of soldiers refused to do it, and they refused on their own, which is tremendously heartening in the otherwise abyss that the rest of those soldiers and their leaders, most importantly, were living. Appreciate the program. Tom, your thoughts when you hear that?
Yeah, it is. Well, first of all, it's so overwhelming to think of an American soldier, who would think at an order like that was in any way, lawful, let alone moral. And the excuse or the explanation, well, we never heard about that in our training. I'm not sure. I would only hope that the training of the Army, as well as I know the Marine Corps and the law of land warfare, would have covered such things. But nevertheless, to still, you know, carry out those orders that, and I think I mentioned to you, about the time that the verdict came out, I was stationed at the Naval Academy, and I was asked to give a talk to the Navy League up in Baltimore, and was asked what my thoughts were on the results of Kelly, and my response was I thought that he should have been shot. And I was amazed at the response of the some World War II and Korean veterans who said, no, 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 don't you understand? Kelly's the victim. You know, he was, you know, don't you, and a Marine captain, that from my third tour, you know, don't you understand combat, captain? You know, when you're taking casualties and the heat of battle and so forth, and I said, stop right there. The only casualty that company took that day was a soldier who shot himself in the foot. You know, this was murder.
Hey, sir,
this was murder.
And when I saw that picture, right, this guy shoots himself in the foot, I thought he did that on purpose. And then,
absolutely.
And then I later found out, you know, in just watching all the different video and listening to the audio I've listened to, that's exactly what he did. He shot himself right in the foot to get his ass out of there because he didn't want to be a part of it. And that was the only way, that was the only way he thought he could do it.
And so then I asked the question, okay, suppose instead of women and children that they put in the ditches and shot, that they were NVA soldiers in uniform, would that have made it any more acceptable? Would that make it any more correct? And the answer, again, is absolutely not. It's even worse that they were shooting point blank. In one of the testimonies, you know, 5 feet away, Callie shooting women and children, mothers trying to protect their babies being shot, a child, a two-year-old, you know, shot. What possibly could have come over those individuals to think that this was the right thing to do? I mean, I'm astounded. And of course, with that comes now the brush that is used to paint so many Vietnam veterans. Well, that's what we mean by baby killers. Well, on that occasion, Mac, I'm sorry to say, there were members of the U.S. Military who were, in fact, baby killers.
You served at the Army Special Warfare School from when to when?
66 to 68.
Okay, so before this all came to light.
Yeah, this took place in 68, and then they learned about it in 69.
Right.
And then the trial was in 71, as I recall.
Right. The my guest this morning on a Thursday edition of All Marine Radio is retired Marine Corps Brigadier General Tom Drowdy. And so you don't mind if we take a break, do you? And then we'll come back and continue the discussion. I have some more email and questions of my own.
You bet. Stand by. Thanks, Mac.
You bet. We are we're just talking about what it was like to lead then. The nation's so different. The war was different than what, you know, the American military was certainly accustomed to. And much of popular culture paints a horrible picture in which guys like Tom Drowdy had to go lead in. And so it's extremely interesting to listen to him and find out the reality. More of All Marine Radio on a Thursday coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. Are you looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military? For a first responder? For a hunter? For an outdoorsman? Or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at battlemug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. Battle Mug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out, battlemug.com.
My name is Juan Perez Jr. I joined the military in 98. I commissioned as an officer, but I always had in mind the idea that I would go into the special operations community, particularly the special forces. I was accepted to go into selection, and I attended on September 8th of 2001. As I was making my departure of the military, there was that uncertainty. What do I do next? How do I repurpose my skills in a way that's not only meaningful to me, but also that provides for my family and provides an increase in our a way of living, a quality of life. The Global South Foundation has resources when it comes to anything from building resumes to how to relate to a CEO in conversation, how to basically, again, repurpose that which I had learned in a career in special operations, dealing at the strategic and operational level. How do I take that and then turn it towards entrepreneurial spirit into business development? And how do I translate that so somebody can see that value? And in doing so, I landed a magnificent and very rewarding career. I'm the VP of operations for an IT company called BuildSourced. What I say to veterans getting out, be bold. Be bold when you go to network. Go out to the Global South website, look at what events they have lined up, attend those events, you know, and participate. A lot of the events they hold, they're of key importance in this network. Go out there and engage, just like you would engage in a combat zone, you know, when you're networking there with folks that don't share necessarily your language, your culture, or your background, and yet we still make it happen. How can we not make it happen here?
The Global South Foundation is a great partner of All Marine Radio. Find out more about them at globalsoftfoundation.org/Marines.
All I can say about militarybyowner.com is, wow, I listed my house on your website for only 2 weeks in a tough rental market, and now my house is about to get rented. I will definitely recommend you guys to everyone in the military. Thank you.
Are you located near a military base? Advertise with Military by Owner for optimum exposure to the military community. Military by Owner has experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base for the past 15 years. MilitaryByOwner.com, proven and dependable.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends, these are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit VeteransCrisisLine.net for free 24/7 confidential support or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
:34 on the West Coast, 11:34 on the East Coast, almost lunchtime. And from the East Coast, Tom Drowdy continues with us. Retired infantry officer, brigadier general, former commanding officer of the 5th Marine Regiment. That's kind of a cool little thing to have in your resume, I would say. I wouldn't mind having that one.
It sure is. I always refer as the 5th Marines as opposed to 5th Marine Regiment. Of course, it is regiment, but that was the correct designation back there, I think, in the teens the Marine Corps made that. So you're the 5th Marines, 6th Marines. That's the one that I always use, but you're correct. It's 5th Marine Regiment.
I think it's kind of like it's shorthand for we Marines, but for if you're not a Marine, that you don't really understand it. And gracious enough, Tom is to come on and talk about We're talking about what it was like to lead. Email, Mac, I'm curious, how frustrating is it for a Vietnam veteran like Tom Drowdy that every movie about Vietnam, it's almost stereotypical that the soldiers or Marines will be doing drugs, they will wear their uniform like ass bags, and the indiscriminate shooting of women and children is almost associated with every film that you see relative to Vietnam. It must be difficult, Tom, to be painted with that brush, yes? No?
Yeah, it is. I used to say it was the stereotype was the war-crazed Vietnam vet. You're absolutely right. It really is frustrating still that most Vietnam movies portray us in that light. Glaring and beautiful counterpoint to that is We Were Soldiers Once and Young, based upon the book by Joe Galloway and General Moore of the true event, of course, the Grand Valley fight in 1965. But reinforced a couple of things in that movie. One, a unit that trained together, went over together, fought brilliantly together, but it was true combat, and it was not portraying the Vietnam fighter or the Vietnam veteran as some kind of a clownish, almost pitiful figure who had to resort to drugs, alcohol, etc. to get the job done. That was not the Marine or the soldier that I was familiar with.
I want to read you a couple of quotes, and I want your reaction. People magazine did a story about Rusty Calley in 1989. He married a woman. He went to work for her father in a jewelry store. He became a gemologist. I guess he ran the store, and he may still be doing that today. Quote. And this is from Ron Ridenour, whose letter led to the investigation. Ridenour, I want to say, was back in Hawaii, or he might have been in Vietnam when he first hears about what happens at quote unquote Pinkville, and he then begins to ask other guys about it because he doesn't believe it, and ultimately he collects enough information that he writes a letter and mails it to, I want to say, 30 to 40 people, ranging from the Secretary of the Army to his congressman, to his senator, yada, yada, yada. And so out of that comes the investigation into My Lai. And this is a quote from him, talking about Callie and Charlie Company. This was not the aberration of one wild officer. My Lai was an act of policy. Callie had his guilt, but he was just one small actor in a very large play. He did not write the script.
We're all masters of our fate and make our own decisions, as Callie did that day. I guess the premise here is that Callie was kind of led to that by a system, a policy, an expectation that he would perform as he did, and I just I find that difficult, if not impossible, to believe. My high regard for the U.S. Army. Despite the difficulties in those days of Vietnam, but that no accountable officer would ever condone in advance the things that took place at My Lai that day. Now, I also have to say that following that, there was a hesitancy or an unwillingness or a disregard to look into things that certainly would raise the suspicion of, I think, a reasonable man. Among others, the report of 120 Viet Cong killed and 20 civilians. And I think that came about as a result of the 20 civilians, the report of the aviation units that saw the bodies. But to accept 120 killed, Mac, one of the bad things about Vietnam, and there are many, were that the metric for success was the body count.
Right.
And good units, and I put that in quotation marks, had good, again quotation marks, body counts. And unless and until you had individuals who saw beyond that and said, wait a minute, this has to be more than just killing a bunch of people, because if we're rewarding bodies, then the natural incentive, the natural inclination is the more bodies, the better. And so that did, in fact, lead to things like inflated body counts, or in the case here at the My Lai, all of those, I don't think any one of them could have been called the Viet Cong. They were all innocent civilians, and yet 120 of them were tallied up as the Viet Cong, and it was accepted and acclaimed by even General Westmoreland as a great victory that had taken place. And that's so. On the one hand, to go in with going in a position of it's okay to kill civilians, I just can't accept that. But on the other hand, there should have been some skepticism on the part of the higher headquarters of what really happened there, and is there more to it? And eventually, of course, it came about, but it came about because of the conscience of good soldiers who said, this wasn't right, I can't live with this anymore. All of those things that brought about the investigation and the subsequent aftermath of My Lai. Not to mention the horrible lack of accountability for the company commander Medina, you know, who in my mind certainly gave the order to waste everything. If it walks, talks, or growls, I think was one of the comments that he made.
If it's breathing, and one of the things that's interesting that you hear, and the interviews that are interesting, they're all interesting in my opinion. And what changes over time is the impact that this has as these guys try to live with it for the rest of their lives. And it happens to them when most of them are probably between the ages of 18 and 21. But you hear them say everything. And what strikes me as odd is they talk about cats, dogs, cats, water buffaloes, anything breathing.
Poison the wells.
The wells. And then the question is, what about women and children? And he said everything. He didn't say kill women and children. He said everything that breathes is VC. It's either VC or a VC sympathizer. Now, to me, what's interesting is, so what does a Taliban sympathizer look like? What does an Al-Qaeda sympathizer look like? And this is where we've kind of grown up as a professional military. It looks like a civilian. Look, they're caught in the middle of this crap, right?
Yep.
Right? And when the president, when President Obama made the announcement that we were pulling out of Afghanistan, you know, our SIGINT people intercepted communications from, you know, the Marja area, you know, to Quetta, saying, hey, we know you're coming back. You know we're dealing with the Americans like we had to deal with the Russians. As soon as you're here, you know we're ready to help. Right? What is that? That is the guy caught in the middle trying to sustain himself.
You know?
That is a Taliban sympathizer. So I get to smoke him. I get to smoke his wife and his kids. And so it's really, I mean, when you hear it, you know, it's chilling that they would say, yeah, you can't tell the difference between them, and that they are open sea. There's open season on them, just like there is on Viet Cong, you know. So it's interesting. Here's another quote for you, and this is from evidently a friend of or somebody who knew Rusty Calley after the war. Rusty doesn't deny what he did. He'll say, I did what they charged me with. Anyone who killed women and children has got to feel remorse. But I think he's come to grips with his conscience. He was following orders. They trained him and ordered him to leave the ground scorched, and he took it literally. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's, I guess to go back to the Nuremberg, you know, defense, which was a non-defense of, I was only following orders. You know, there's got to be, in all of us, Mac, certainly, and most especially in Marines, and we pride ourselves on our discipline and semper fidelis and always loyal and so forth. But along with that comes, the fact that we're still human, breathing, thinking human beings. And when we receive, or if we receive an order that is illegal or immoral, it is our obligation to say, sir, ma'am, wait a second, let me make sure I've got this right, and then repeat it to make sure that what is stated is as you understand it, and then that determination, that moment of truth of, are you going to carry out an illegal or immoral order or not, and bear the consequences. And it's, you know, one of those terrible situations. Not even ethical. It's not a right versus a right. It's a right versus a wrong. But in choosing the hard right over the easy wrong, you know, there are consequences. We all understand what it means to disobey an order and to bring upon the person who brought that or who made that order the attention, the spotlight, so to speak, that would bring that about. But unless that happens, we really become kind of mindless robots of, you know, punch in the order, and it's going to be carried out regardless of the consequence, regardless of the conditions, regardless of the factors, regardless of the morality, regardless of laws of land warfare, regardless of just war. I mean, those things that we're supposed to stand for, and I believe we do stand for, they can't just go out the window because somebody says, well, that was my order, and I had to carry it out. And as difficult as that is, that's the way it just has to be. And then the reason that we teach things like the law of land warfare and a just war, to understand that there can be times when these may come into question and what is required of you as a member of the armed forces and most especially as a leader.
All right, another email. Matt, question for Tom. I heard you musing yesterday. Why was this not shoved in your face as some kind of case study as a Marine officer? Because it's so full of learning. So why do you think, you know, I mean, I don't ever remember sitting through a class on Mili. Because let me tell you, when you sit there and watch the videotape of their statements of what happened, nobody needs to explain anything to you. And it's not, you know, the SJA standing up there and giving a class, which, you know, you're sitting there doodling while it goes through. You know, it tends to be a little bit more gripping, you know, when you're watching people that actually went through things talking about them. And so to me, I've thought about that over the course of the last couple of days. Why was I never taught this? Why was this never shoved in my face as okay, we're going to do we're going to have a discussion about the law of land warfare. But first, I want you to see a few things, and here's what I want you to pay attention to. Because it is chilling. Why do you think is MILI something that, you know, we really don't want to embrace in our formal schools, or, you know, just no, or do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, Mac, what a great question that is, because I don't recall, other than, you know, studying on my own,
right,
going through a case study on MILI or delving into the issues the way you're doing right now, as an example, or that could have or should have been done as part of the training. I think it gets into, in many ways, what is supposed to be taught and then how you teach it. And And it's so easy to just read, you know, from the UCMJ of the do's and do nots. But to give examples requires a little more preparation, a little more thought, a little more effort, such as researching into something like the Marine Corps had its own. It's called, I have a book on Song Tong by Lieutenant Colonel Gary Solis,
right,
about the Marines' My Lai, if you will. You know, why don't we know more about that, of what took place and why, and the events went into, so we can, you know, step back and say, what would I have done at what point, and how would I have accomplish it. You know, these case studies are ideal learning tools, but unfortunately not used as often as they should. So you bring up a great point, and My Lai couldn't have been a better case study of a failure of leadership, of accountability, of moral correct. I mean, all of the things that we expect of our military, and especially our leaders, it should have been better used. I agree.
Well, you know, and one of the things that you know, the commandant, again, if you look at these kind of incidents, then what you come to conclude is that they have certain things in common. And most of the time, this is not the first time that a unit has gone down this road. They've stuck their toe in the water with other types of lack of discipline. And they've cut corners, and now they're in a position where they decide what parts of Marine Corps that they do and where they cheat. And so when you get away from that standard, you know, and hopefully you have somebody that grabs you and pulls you back when you're weak. Another leader that says, hey, you don't want to go down that road, okay, come back here.
Yeah.
And you know, there's an interesting part of the series the Pacific, in which Eugene Sledge, on I believe it might be Okinawa, after refusing to do it, he's going to quote unquote field strip a Japanese soldier, which entailed, you know, taking gold fillings out of teeth and things like that, and the kid from Louisiana. And his name escapes me at the time, but he's in the series Pacific. I think he's the best actor in the whole thing, because he affects this kind of interesting personality. He has this Louisiana drawl, and he looks at him and he says, and who does this on a regular basis? And he sees Sledge start to do it, and he looks at him and he says, Sledgehammer, you don't want to do that, man. And he says, you do it. He says, man, there's nasty stuff in that mouth. Don't do it, Sledgehammer. Don't do it. And he's pulling him back, you know, as a friend, as a peer, as a friend would. And Tom, whether you're urinating on bodies in Afghanistan, whether you're calling a recruit a terrorist at Paris Island, whether you're forcing a recruit to lie in bleach, or you're yanking somebody out of a house in Iraq, flex cuffing them and shooting them to death. Okay, these things all have things in common. And so to me, this whole crusade of keep your honor clean, what you need to do for young people is put this stuff in their face. And let me just show you, it's not only bad to do today, but you're going to live with it forever.
Yep.
You're going to live for it forever. You know, I was reading one of these guys, you know, this will surprise nobody, My Lai guy. He winds up homeless after losing his job. He can't control his drinking, migrates to drugs. He has this explosive anger thing going on. And he dies as a result of a knife fight over a bottle of bourbon as a homeless guy. And so, and that's not atypical that might be atypical, but if you look at the mental torment that these soldiers and Marines suffer on the backside of their moral failure, It's the price is horrendous. The juice certainly isn't worth the squeeze. And so to me, this whole concept, I'm going to start my own company that does keep your honor clean training. You want to hire me? I'll come in, and I won't have to say a whole lot of words, because the power of their own words, their own statements, and then what they live with is all young Marines need to see. Do you want to go down that road?
Yeah.
Now, do you understand the significance in intervening? And because, again, what you do in life echoes in eternity. You can't get away from it. So it's they're incredible lessons. Incredible lesson.
Well, yeah, and I just quickly go back to our last conversation about breaking ranks and that individual who sees that and does it. But the other thing is that this is part of the horrible after effects of torture. One of the victims of torture is not just the person being tortured, but the torturer. And what it does to that individual's psyche, soul, et cetera. At one time in France, there was a garden industry and psychiatrists who were dealing with French soldiers who had tortured in Algeria, who were trying to live with the things that they had done. It wears at the soul of an individual. I mean, it's bad enough, the effects of killing someone in combat. No ifs, ands, or buts, but to torture another human being or to murder another human being is just that's got to be such a tremendous weight on the soul of any individual, and it is going to have its effect. So, yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. There is that aspect that the derivative effects, if you will, of that kind of conduct in combat.
Another email question for you. Mac, first of all, I just want to commend you for doing the program. You never hear programs like this. First of all, I don't want to pump any sunshine up your ass as an interviewer, but your experiences in both life and as a Marine make you unique among interviewers. So well done there, Devil Dog. Now, my question is this. I heard General Zinni in the tapes that you put on your website talk about encountering Marines that had scalps and also encountering Marines that showed him pictures of mutilated bodies. He said that he tore those things up. He also said that the reaction that he got when he reacted like that was a reaction of relief that this was no longer going to be tolerated and it was going to be off limits because Marines did not want to do it. They did not want to stand by as others did it, but it seemed to infect their unit. I'm curious about General Dirawdy's observations. It seems like strong leaders triumph throughout, and it is that way. And where you have weak leaders, and Cali certainly seemed to be one, that all these other forces, when left out of control, will manifest themselves in bad things. Appreciate the program. Always appreciate hearing General Dirawdy. So, sir, is it simply a function of weak leadership?
Yeah, I think so. Weak leadership, but the basis of that is the individual, and you know we work with what we've got, who we are, the way we're raised, et cetera. But then comes the education and training that develops us into the leaders that have to make those critical calls at critical points in time. And I make a differentiation between training and education. Training is preparation for certainty. Education is preparation for uncertainty. And in combat, you're going to face a lot more uncertainty than certainty. And so there's got to be not just the training of how to do things, but the education. And the education, to me, means using examples and case studies and to bring about the critical thinking before the event occurs. One I'll just get back to is a question I threw out to students when I was teaching at Man of Staff College at the Quantico. Are you going to torture? Now, and I want you to think about that in this air-conditioned classroom with no one screaming or hollering, no explosions going on, no stress, no radios, no. I want you to think about that here because you may face that, and I want you to not go through that thought process for the first time under those conditions. I think all of this is incumbent on us as we're teaching leaders to, as best as possible, prepare them for those really tough situations when they've got to make those demanding, sometimes terrible decisions. And we do that, I think, through better education and to use the examples, the good and the bad, to bring that about. One that quickly you mentioned the pressure of the peers to, you don't do that. General Pace gives a great example of when he's a platoon commander in Vietnam, and a great young Marine Lance Corporal from New York had been killed by a shot from a sniper from the village. And so Lieutenant Pace is calling in an artillery strike on the village. And his platoon sergeant stands in front of them and without saying a word just looks in his eyes. And the message was loud and clear. Lieutenant, don't do this. And so Lieutenant Pace called off the artillery strike. They went into the village. Of course, it's loaded with women and children who would have been killed. Of course, there's no sniper. He departed a long time ago. But, that reinforcement that we all need from time to time of choose that hard right over the easy wrong. Do the right thing for the right reasons. And as sanctimonious and as pious pablum like that this may sound, I mean, I just firmly believe that that's what's required to be successful, not just in combat, but as an individual, and later on in life as a husband, a father, a mother, a wife, a friend, a comrade. You've just got to reach down and find that better self that's in all of us, and let that make the right call.
Final example of this, and hit me in the face last night. Have you seen the story about the woman in Minneapolis who called police and then they shot her?
Yeah.
Okay. My cousin's husband is a police officer in Sacramento, California. In 1996, my oldest sister's husband murdered their only two sons, 4 years old and 6 years old, shot them both in the head, and then put the pistol in his mouth and blew his head off. I want to say 9 months before that, they had a prowler in their backyard. My cousin's husband, who's a great guy, father, a World War II veteran in the Pacific, United States Army in the Philippines and whatnot, and a very patriotic guy, loves military history. He's on patrol with his dog. He's a canine guy. And so he hears shots fired in the vicinity of my sister's house. So he rolls over there. As a canine officer, he's in general support of the city, right? So he goes where he wants. And so, he gets to my sister's house. Another two officers have my sister's husband handcuffed in the back of their police car. They've run his, they know he's on parole because he slapped and punched my sister previously. So he's on parole. Now he's a parolee. He's not allowed to have a weapon. So he's cuffed in the back of their car. They've got the weapon. My sister's begging him, please, Joe, don't let them do this, blah, 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 blah. He intercedes, he talks to him, they let him out of the vehicle, and he gives him back the pistol that's used in the murder of the two boys. Now, so he and I are talking about the thing that happened in Minneapolis, we're talking about, and then I start just talking about me lie with him. Because, I mean, he's a police officer for 30 years, and they deal with PTS and blah, 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 blah. And all of a sudden, I had forgot about this, how he had incredible, he lives with incredible guilt that him not doing the right thing, him handing that pistol back, was one of the keys to those two little boys being murdered. And I said to him, when I'd never been to the house where it happened, I didn't like the guy, I wouldn't be a part of it, you know, all of that kind of stuff in my family. So after, I don't know, maybe before I got ready to go to Afghanistan, so this happened in 96, so in the summer of 2010, I'm in Sacramento, I said, would you take me to the house and show me what happened? And he said, it's not easy for me, but yeah, I'll do that for you. So, as we're there, he's breaking down and telling me about it, and he blames himself. And I looked at him and I said, you know what? If you would have kept the pistol, okay, do you not think he would have gone out and got another one within a day or two?
Surely.
Right? And he looked at me and he said, if you were me, would you blame yourself? And I said, yeah, I blame myself. He said, that's what I live with. And I said, you know, what you needed was one of those other police officers when you were being weak as a leader, being conflicted, to grab you and say, hey, bud, you know, we'll let him go. We'll keep the pistol. And help you, support you as a leader, right?
Yeah.
And now, you know, to his credit, he goes and speaks to police academy classes about, you know, why you have to do the right thing and what you have to live with if you don't. And so, that hit me and I was even thinking about that, talking about me lying and what you live with, and all of a sudden, boom, and I had, you know, keeping your honor clean is a huge deal. What I think, though, I think the Marine Corps is making a huge mistake by not developing cases that involve every one of these incidences once they've been adjudicated. The incident in 2006, the 3-5 incident in Hamdia, yep. The urination incident, every one of their statements, everything on videotape ought to be just stuck in front of the faces of Marines. This is what happened. And this is what they live with today. And I would say you reach out to the Marines that were a part of this and say, hey, look, you know, people make mistakes. We want you to help us turn that into a positive for future Marines. Would you care? Now, I imagine some will say no, go to hell. But there will be some that say yes. And in some way, shape, or form, it'll help them live with what they did, that they're at least turning it into something positive. So, anyway. Anyway, all right, sir. Final thoughts, me lie, and being a leader of that war, in that war, and of that generation of Marines, does it really come down to simple leadership? That if you care about them, if you love them, if you're willing to do the right thing, all those other things can swirl around you, and you'll be okay.
Heck, I think there are truly enduring virtues and values. And I venture to say that a good leader of Marines in 1775 would be a good leader of Marines today, despite the totally different circumstances that would be obvious. But, you know, the requirement of the leader to truly, set the pace, to establish the culture in that unit of what's okay and what's not okay, is so vitally important, and that's the reason that being a leader is such an awesome responsibility, yet the tremendous satisfaction that it has in being able to do the right thing for the right reasons. I remember just quickly a story I was reading when we were in Hawaii. General Krulak and I are still the best of friends, and I read a book called The Good War by Studs Terkel.
Right,
there's
right.
an example in it of a Marine in World War II, and he was, there's one occasion, was a dead Japanese was there, and the Marine was going to shoot the top of the dead Japanese penis off. And as he's getting into the firing position, the corpsman said to him, "Jones, whatever your name, what would your parents think?" And then it suddenly hit him that, yeah, there were other atrocities of the dead and so on, but what would your parents think? And it just, it suddenly hit him. My God, yeah, absolutely right. So I remember saying to General Kulak, you know, one of the things that our Marines that we led in Vietnam perhaps are thankful for is that they can live with themselves for the things that they never did because we wouldn't allow it. And I think that's part of the responsibility of a leader is not only the welfare of our Marines in combat, but also what's going to be the far-ranging effects. And when they leave, are they going to be better people, men, women, husbands, wives, et cetera, than when they came in? And will that be as a result of our leadership, or will they be worse as a result of our so-called leadership?
All right, a final question for you. It's an email one. Mac, you were talking about the song yesterday, the phrase, "to keep our honor clean," inserted in our song, "Lo, so many years ago." Was it an accident? Was it something that rhymed? Or did they know? You have an opinion about, did they know, sir?
Yeah, I think so. I think good people have good instincts. And I believe that they are inspired by God, Holy Ghost, whatever you look for the basis for it. But just as our founding fathers, I believe we're divinely inspired to put together this magnificent document called the Constitution, and then later the Bill of Rights. I think that was divinely inspired, because to keep our honor clean is required if we truly are you know, that the first to fight and the ones that you want to send in first to handle the battles of the Corps and to protect our citizenry. So honor is precious, and it's got to be kept clean.
All right. So first of all, I appreciate you coming on and talking about this. I would dare say this. It's important for Americans to hear, you know, that it wasn't all the way they see in Apocalypse Now, and that 99% of the guys who fought in Vietnam did it the right way, and I think that's an important part of this story. So appreciate you coming on. Appreciate you talking about the challenges of leadership at that time, and have a great day.
Yeah, Mac, a quick plug for the Ken Burns series starting on the 17th of September on the Vietnam War. I've seen a preview of it, only 25 minutes, but one of the advisors is Carl Molantis, the Marine Navy Cross recipient.
Right.
From what I saw, it does not have an agenda. I believe it's going to be an objective view of Vietnam. Lots of difficult things to watch, but I think every American should watch it. So, put that on your calendar.
Will do, sir. Thank you.
Okay, you bet. God bless you, and Semper Fidelis, Mac.
Semper Fidelis. Brigadier General Tom Drowdy. The gunner set to join us momentarily here on Thursday. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on the All Warrior Radio Network. Looking for the perfect gift for somebody who's in the military? For a first responder? For a hunter? For an outdoorsman? Or somebody that just likes cool military stuff? I've got the perfect gift for you. The Battle Mug. Starts as 10 pounds of aluminum. It's milled, machined, anodized, adorned with Picatinny rails, and then stamped with the serial number, and it's ready for you to make your own. Anything that went on your rifle or pistol can go on your mug. Scope, laser, camera, light. Put a lid on it, and you're ready for the field. If you're inside, add a flag and an emblem, and you're set. Perfect for any commemorative event. Farewell, promotion, retirement, birthday, anniversary, or get out of the doghouse. The Battle Mug is the perfect unique gift. Check out the entire line of product at BattleMug.com. Enter the promo code Marine for 15% off. BattleMug is a veteran-owned and operated company. The product is made entirely in the United States. Check it out, BattleMug.com.
MilitaryByOwner.com is an excellent resource for any military family moving to a new area. We found a ton of homes to choose from and purchased a house 8 days later. This was the only site I used. Thanks, Military by Owner.
Are you PCSing? Do you need to find a home near a military base quickly? With over 45,000 listings and 15 years of experience helping military families find, sell, or rent their home near a military base, MilitaryByOwner.com can help. Military by Owner. Proven and dependable.